Dr. Anthony Eslin will be speaking on the topic of imagination and education at the second annual Wittenberg Academy Family Retreat, which will be held at Camp Okoboji in Milford, Iowa on April 27th through the 29th, 2017. Join us and be immersed in God's Word, thoughtful discussions, and family fun. For more information or to register, visit www.wittenbergacademy.org and click on the registration tab.
I was blessed to be raised in a churched home. My mother and father taught me that to whom much is given, much is expected.
This is why identity politics can never work. Every person at his core has one particular thing that they really identify.
He ran in 2008 as saying that he was open to all kinds of restrictions on abortion, and yet his administration never put forward any restriction on abortion of its own, and that's something that they should be held accountable for, too.
Archaeology shows that again and again. I do not know of a single discovery that shows the Bible is simply wrong.
Anglican priests in Wisconsin, surrounded by Lutherans, love issues, etc.
It's slowly dawning on some of us, and some of us are slower on the uptake than others. It's slowly dawning on us that the problem in Western civilization is far more serious than we had at first supposed. Not just a slow slide down a slippery slope, but near the bottom of the slope and ready to cross over the edge, if we haven't in part already crossed over that edge, past that sign, the point of no return. How did we get here? Why is it that we are not only unwilling to think in terms of truth and falsehood, but increasingly unable to do so? Welcome back to Issues Etc. on this Monday afternoon, the 20th of February. I'm Todd Wilkin. Thanks for tuning us in. We're going to talk about the decay of Western civilization and the restoration of truth. Dr. Anthony Eslin joins us. He is a regular guest professor of English at Providence College and author of several books, including his latest, Out of the Ashes, Rebuilding American Culture. Dr. Eslin, welcome back to Issues Etc.
Thank you, Todd. It's great to be back.
You have kind of been touched by this personally recently, kind of felt for yourself in your own context, part of the decay of Western culture. Tell us your story.
Well, I'll tell a little bit of it. It's a long story. We at Providence College have long had a program in the development of Western civilization. All freshmen and all sophomores have had to take this class. It's a four-semester class. And we're talking about many decades now we've had this. But it's always come under fire from the usual suspects, basically people who either don't see any particular use in studying literature, philosophy, theology, history, or from people who we've got this strange idea that everything evil in the history of the world springs from the West. So it's come under fire for a long time. And now it's in the political crosshairs because there are some vocal students egged on by professors who basically want to dismantle the program or to subordinate it to current political concerns, which would destroy it. And I wrote a couple of articles 7 months apart defending the program and saying that, you know, if you're talking to me about cultural diversity, we study 12 or 13 different cultures in the first year of this program alone. So what do you even mean? Well, that brought down the wrath of the politically correct upon my head. And I was singled out in a most unusual way. It's never happened here before. Letters from the president and vice president going around to every single student and every single faculty member, singling me out for reproach. And, you know, think, hey, even the administration at my own college does not really believe in the value of a dispassionate study of the Western heritage. It's all political now.
If you don't mind me asking, what in particular did they have the administration have to say about you? How did they characterize your approach?
Well, because I said that if you have cultural diversity on your lips and yet you show no real interest in being introduced to the ancient Greeks, the ancient Babylonians, ancient Romans, Hebrews, the early Christians, the Germanic tribes, medieval France, medieval Italy, etc., etc., etc. Then, but you want to substitute for that some study that has to do with what you conceive to be your identity. I said, well, there's something narcissistic about that, and that caused them to go ballistic. And I also said, that in our own diversity webpage, we seem to affirm the cheered on, the list of cheered on alphabet soup of sexual proclivities that are, you know, cheered every place. So the LGBTQ, WERT, etc. And I mean, we're a Catholic college, so why would you single out these sexual sins for approval or sympathy? But what about all the other sins, sexual and otherwise? Can't we have interest groups to promote their cause? You know, thieves and adulterers and so on. Well, they didn't care for that either. So, I had to be singled out as a very bad man. It's not nice.
You write at the beginning of your book, you say, we now have what every single one of the founders, Federalists and Anti-Federalists, both, would have considered tyrannical. It's a tangled mess. And there are many people who are watching, say, the unrest on college campuses, and they're wondering, how did we get to this point where young people are favorable towards these kind of tyrannies like socialism? They're critical of democracy. They seem to disregard many parts of the Constitution, particularly the First Amendment. How did we get to this?
Through many avenues. Let me just take one. It's involved dethroning truth, right? If you believe that we can only speak reasonably about truth if we're talking about that very, very narrow range of things that have to do with empirical observations that can be measured, okay? But outside of that, it is nonsense to talk about truth. If that's what you believe, then you've already given the entire ball game away. And when that filters down to the rest of your society, we're going inevitably to have both anarchy and totalitarian impulses, right? Because power is the only thing that's left. When truth is out of the way, moral truth, aesthetic truth, wisdom, when that's out of the way, something's got to rush in to fill the vacuum. And what rushes in are the desires for power among the most ambitious of us. I mean, all bets are off then, right? I mean, the same thing happened in the Soviet Union. That's why Solzhenitsyn repeats something that a peasant had told him before he converted back to the Orthodox Church, that these disasters have befallen us human beings because we have forgotten God. Well, you kick God and truth off the throne, power and ambition come in. And so what you see play out on college campuses are just power games. We are going to do what we want to do in order to get our way. And truth be damned. The truth is neither here nor there.
What did the founders know on all sides of the issues surrounding the founding of the American Republic? What did they know about the constant danger of tyranny that we have forgotten?
Oh, my gosh. So our founders, and not just the two or three most learned among them, but in general, that generation of men who were at the Continental Congresses, the local state legislatures, the Constitutional Congress, and so on, those guys were steeped in ancient history. Whether they read Latin or Greek well or not, they would read about these things in English translation. They were steeped also in English history and European history. The consensus of all of that is that tyranny is a moral problem before it's a political problem. All of the ancients speak as one with regard to this. If you're talking about a people who cannot restrain their appetites, okay, who don't know that their own appetites can tyrannize over them, if you don't know that, if you've forgotten that, well, then you're going to have tyranny. Forget about the political structure that you come up with. You're going to have tyranny. Tyranny begins at home. tyranny begins within the human soul. They understood that. So they understood that because they were setting up a government that allowed great leeway for people to do as they please most hours of the day, days of the week, they understood that they were playing with fire, because this could only work if people exercised considerable restraint over their appetites. They had to govern themselves. Right? So their sense of moral laws and moral duties had to be stronger in the United States than it might have to be in a place where central government was more powerful, or where lives were more directly governed by various institutions of the church and the state. We've forgotten all of that. So we seem to think that freedom means giving free rein to your appetites. Every single founding father would have said, excuse me, that's not freedom, that's license, and it goes hand in hand with tyranny. Every single one of them would have said that. From the deist Jefferson to all the Christians there, they all knew it. They all got it from Christian teaching, from the great poets, and from the pagans. They spoke with one voice.
So we're talking here in part about what in some traditions, maybe even the Catholic tradition, would be called a keen awareness of natural law.
Yeah, yeah. What, and that's another thing that they inherited from the ancients. This is not something that Christians and Jews invented. They saw the common ground that they shared with the pagans who were near them. That the pagans didn't get everything right, but they got some things right. The Romans called it the law of nations, and it wasn't because there was any international governing body like the United Nations saying, okay, look here, you this nation over here ought to do that in order to compensate this other nation. They didn't have that, but they understood that there was kind of overarching law that would govern how nations ought to deal with one another based upon natural reason. That was not controversial. That there was such a thing is not controversial. It's controversial now only because we want to do as we please. It was not controversial to our forefathers.
I want to take some of this apart, kind of piece by piece, if we could. The famous saying that if we forget the past, we're doomed to repeat its mistakes. Why does it seem that many have not learned from the mistakes of the past?
Well, here's a funny thing. I'm going to tweak this a little bit here. For several generations now, we've been taught to despise the past, to look down upon it. So we don't really learn a whole lot about it. We assume that it has really nothing to teach us. So we are in the worst possible shape, because though we might learn from the mistakes that our forefathers made if we read about them, we don't read about them, so we'll make those same mistakes. But because we are so proud, because we've got this progressive myth that, you know, it's always ever onwards and upwards in human history, morally speaking, because of that, we refuse to learn from their successes, to emulate their greatness. So, I mean, we may be the first generation of people, or the first generations of people in the history of the world, who get a kick out of bringing down their own ancestors, of believing the worst about them, to make ourselves look better, because frankly, we don't have much by way of real accomplishments, moral, artistic, cultural accomplishments. We don't have a whole lot. So in order to make ourselves look good, we have to run down our own grandparents. So we learn neither from their mistakes, nor are we taught by their wisdom. We're basically idiots when it comes to that.
Dr. Anthony Esselin is our guest. We're talking about the decay of Western civilization and the restoration of truth. He's author of the book, Out of the Ashes, Rebuilding American Culture. He says if our language is inane and empty, our thoughts will be inane and empty too. We'll find out what he's talking about after this.
Are you a homeschool parent looking for help teaching certain subjects? Or do you want your student to study the history, languages, and literature of Western civilization? Memoria Press Online Academy has live online classes with master teachers to help you. Their teachers have years of experience teaching, delighting, and moving students literally from all around the world. Your homeschool year doesn't have to be difficult. Visit memoriapressacademy.com or call 877-745-8866.
Are you tired of working nights, weekends, and odd hours trying to cover your bases at home just to make ends meet? At the Cleaning Authority, we call that the multi-job shuffle, and we want to end that for you right now. We'll train you in our proven, efficient cleaning methods, and you'll be partnered to work in pre-qualified homes. Call 314-416-8117 and walk away from the multi-job shuffle with a future in our St. Louis office, 314-416-8117.
Contending for truth in an age of anti-truth, you're listening to Issues Etc.
We talk to the biggest names in religion today, liberal bishop John Shelby Spong.
I don't think Jesus ever preached the Sermon on the Mount, for example. I don't believe anybody ever took five loaves and two fish and fed 5,000 people. I don't believe that's possible to do.
Liberal Bible critic Bart Ehrman.
There's a difference between what the historical Jesus actually said and what the Gospels say he said. And to understand what the historical Jesus was really like, we have to get behind the Gospels.
Muslim critic of Christianity Reza Aslan.
By definition, the resurrection is an ahistorical event, and so therefore historians have no right, no business commenting upon it.
Where else on Christian radio will you hear these guests challenged with important questions? Talk radio for the thinking Christian, Issues Etc. Listen live or on demand at issuesetc.org.
Welcome back to Issues Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. We're talking about the decay of Western civilization, the restoration of truth with Dr. Anthony Esselin. He is author of the book Out of the Ashes, Rebuilding American Culture, and professor of English at Providence College. Dr. Esselin, you say that if our language is inane and empty, our thoughts will be inane and empty too. What are you talking about?
Well, here's the thing I challenge people to do quite a lot. Take several forms. You can pick up popular magazines written 120 years ago. These are things that I collect. Just read around in them. Read what an ordinary subscriber to a particular magazine would send in as a letter to the editor. Or read the journals of Civil War soldiers, or the diaries that these people sent home, or the journals of explorers and travelers of the time, right? And what you find there is language that is sophisticated, often beautiful, never stupid, okay? It's at worst workmanlike, but extremely intelligent. And at best, it's downright lovely, beautiful, wonderful. And these are not college professors writing this. Sometimes you just got a soldier in a war, or a person who is writing home from Italy, or from Turkey or someplace like that. You look at that and you say, what do we have now that's comparable? Well, we have nothing comparable. So instead, take a contemporary magazine, pull it off the shelf, if you can stand the obscenity on the cover, look inside, and what you look at by comparison, instead of reading the words of a thoroughly grown-up human being, you're reading the sublingual expressions of a nasty adolescent who might be 50 years old. All you have to do is set things side by side this way. And you want to gasp. You want to weep. You want to weep. You say, well, how come ordinary human beings were capable of that then? And look what we have now.
Maybe this is kind of a magnified version of what you're talking about. It was a couple of years ago, I was reading a bunch of biographies, and in that vein, some correspondence between Adams and Jefferson. And you only have to read one or two letters,
I know,
to realize that these men were intellectual giants, probably
right,
among men of their day. But even with that said, they were not more educated than, you know, everyone. They were, in a lot of ways, just kind of average American colonial gentlemen.
Yeah.
And they make us seem Lilliputian in terms of their ability to express truth.
That we are Lilliputian. we have stuffed our heads with inanities. When these people wrote, let's say you're a fairly intelligent, you're a naturally intelligent man in 1880. You've never gone to college, you know. A lot of the Grover Cleveland, I don't believe, ever went to college. You've read some good books. There's no real garbage out there for you to read. Now, there might be books that aren't really that good, but there's not a whole lot of linguistic garbage. What you have in your head are the rhythms of the King James Bible, John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, the plays of Shakespeare, Milton's Paradise Lost, the contemporary writings of maybe professors who have read Latin and Greek. You know, you have or sermons, collections of sermons by intelligent men, you know, the Wesleys and Whitefield and so on. That's all in your head. That's what language sounds like to you when you sit down with a pen and paper, right? And what comes from them is, like I said, the very worst, it's workmanlike, but it's always intelligent. We have in our heads garbage, complete linguistic garbage. My college freshman can't write as well as an ordinary 12 or 13-year-old living in, say, 1880, 1890, who's been reading Huckleberry Finn and works by other popular authors and is still in school and reads the Bible. That kid at age 12 or 13 in 1890 will write much better than my college freshmen and sophomores will write. I mean, it's almost as if they're not even doing the same kinds of things. The one is using language in an intelligent way. The other, it's like comparing a handsome building versus rubble to rubble. There's almost no comparison.
So you're really talking this isn't just language for language's sake, but the lexicon, the syntax, the grammar of how truth is expressed. You're talking about language for truth's sake.
Language for truth, yeah. For truth and beauty, yeah. Imagine a culture that has somehow lost the knowledge of the wheel, right? They might still enjoy the inherited riches from their ancestors. They can live off that for quite a long time, maybe, if they're rich enough. But in important ways, they're not at all like their forebears. The cultural chain has been snapped. I think that has happened to us. If you went to any English teacher for 7th or 8th grade, let's say, in 1920, and said, I want you to look at this sentence here and describe for me exactly the grammatical relationship of each word in the sentence to every other word. That English teacher would be able to do it, zip, 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 right through. Not one English teacher in 1,000 can do that now. I know, because my students know no grammar. They haven't been taught it. The teachers themselves don't know it. It's gone. It's no longer a subject. It's the flotsam and jetsam of grammar that's taught. A couple of rules here and there, and half the time they're wrong.
And what does that do to our ability, as you say, not only to express truth, but to even think truthful thoughts?
Well, it's kind of analogous to what would happen to our music if we lost the 12-tone scale. It would be just a sort of random collection of tones, glob. It would be a mess. And that's what we have now. We have a mess. The way we write, the way we speak, we don't even pause to define what our terms mean. And this afflicts every one of us into college, through college. My college, for instance, is committed to what is called diversity. Well, the first question that anybody would have asked before the day before yesterday, right, is, well, what the heck do you mean by that? What is that? What are you talking about? Diversity, a synonym for that might be variety. Well, our college is committed to variety. That sentence doesn't even make any sense. A person who speaks that sentence, if you said that sentence in 1890,
our institution of higher learning is committed to variety, you would be laughed at. Or someone would look at you as if you, well, you maybe had drunk some bad hooch. Why is your mind not working? Because a sentence makes no sense. And yet we use sentences like that all the time. It's habitual with us. We habitually write and say things that have no meaning at all.
You have said with respect to education that for all the calls for educational reform, it has now reached the point of being irreformable. Is that something you've said, and what do you mean by it?
Well, let's say that you've got this school down the road here, and we have English classes at the school. But it's like having the title or like having the bare outside of a building when the whole inside has been blown to pieces. You have English, but the English teachers do not know English literature. They don't know English grammar. Their own writing is abominable. How can you reform that? You would have to fire just about everybody and replace them with people who actually did know English literature and love it and did know English grammar. Where are you going to find them? There aren't a whole lot of them running around. Then you have other people there who think it's a really good thing to introduce 11 and 12-year-old kids to various forms of sexual perversity. Well, if they did that as private citizens, you'd have the cops calling on their door, and they'd be hauled into jail for corrupting the morals of minors. But they think it's perfectly fine to do that for whole classes of kids all at once. Rather than just corrupt one kid in your living room, you can put filthy stuff before the eyes of 30 or 40 at once. People who believe that that's a good thing to do, I don't know that they can be reformed. I mean, they certainly can't be trusted with the welfare of your kids. This would be like asking for wise laws governing marriage and the reform of divorce laws to strengthen marriage to hire a bunch of prostitutes to draft the laws. It's not going to happen. It's a dead loss. Now, that doesn't mean that if you're at one of these schools, you shouldn't stay there and do what you can. I mean, certainly in the middle of a battlefield with the dead and the dying all around us, there's a place for people to be there and actually pull somebody out of the fire. But as an institution itself, I don't see it beyond reform. You'd have to re-educate pretty much all the teachers in the country. Not going to happen.
Of course, we can't talk about education or reforming education without talking about the lifeblood of education, which is, let's face it, money. And this is what Dr. Esselin has written. He says the true patriot doesn't send a check to Benedict Arnold, hoping that some of it will make it back to Washington's army. We'll let him make that point after the break.
We know that you want to build your family on the right foundation from the very start, the foundation of Jesus Christ. Concordia Publishing House offers more than 8,000 products for churches, schools, and homes, dedicated customer service, and an experienced staff to help you focus on what matters most. Click to connect at cph.org. Concordia Publishing House, listening, responding, providing for God's people. Concordia Publishing House, cph.org.
Hello, I'm Pastor Daniel Quinn, Senior Pastor of Living Word Lutheran Church, The Woodlands, Texas, inviting you to join us for divine service on Sundays at 8:15 or 11 a.m. Living Word is located at 9500 North Panther Creek Drive in The Woodlands, a community about 30 miles north of Houston. That's Living Word Lutheran Church, where we proclaim the living word of Christ that all who hear may walk in newness of life.
This is a message for members of Thrivent Financial for Lutherans. Thrivent Financial has a charitable grant program called Thrivent Choice. Thrivent Choice allows you to designate charitable outreach funds to Lutheran Public Radio. For more information, look for the Thrivent logo under the Donate page of our website, issuesetc.org, or ask your Thrivent representative about Thrivent Choice. Help support the worldwide outreach of Issues Etc. with Thrivent Choice.
Deaconesses are women trained to share the gospel of Jesus Christ through works of mercy, spiritual care, and teaching of the Christian faith. The word deaconess means servant. Find out more on how you can serve in the Lutheran Church Missouri Synod through the vocation of deaconess at lcms.org/deaconess. Working in faith, laboring in love, remaining steadfast in the hope of our Lord Jesus Christ. LCMS Deaconess Ministry, lcms.org/deaconess.
Where Christianity meets culture, you're listening to Issues, Etc.
I think every man, every Christian should consider, at least, the possibility of God calling him into the holy ministry.
Issues, Etc. regular guest, Dr. Carl Fekencher of Concordia Theological Seminary, Fort Wayne, Indiana.
Because that's the way that God has designed for faith in Christ Jesus to be spread, for the gift of eternal life that Christ Jesus earned by his death and resurrection to be shared with people by the washing of baptism for infants and for adults, for the instruction, the proclamation of the word that happens on a nonstop basis in God's kingdom. God uses people, he uses men to be those proclaimers, to be those men who share the sacraments.
If you've ever considered becoming a pastor, contact Concordia Theological Seminary in Fort Wayne, Indiana. Their phone number, 1-800-481-2155, 1-800-481-2155, or visit ctsfw.edu.
Welcome back to Issues, Etc. I'm Todd Wilkin. Dr. Anthony Esselin is our guest, professor of English at Providence College, author of the book Out of the Ashes, Rebuilding American Culture. We're talking about the restoration of truth. Of course, the lifeblood of education that we were discussing before the break is money, and you acknowledge that. You say it's the most needed resource, but you write this. The true patriot doesn't send a check to Benedict Arnold, hoping that some of it will make its way back to Washington's army. What's your point?
Well, if we're going to support schools, let's support schools and not those institutions that still bear the name of school, but are basically spreading a stupidity unknown in the history of man, far and wide. So let's say, for instance, you have this Catholic school over there that has decided to capitulate to the spirit of the age. So now the education that's going on in that school is indistinguishable from what's going on at the public school nearby. Well, why should you support that with your money? Why should you say, well, you know, I'm going to send some money there. It's maybe there's still some kids there who'll get a good teacher now and then. Forget it. Meantime, there are these new schools that don't need reform because they've seen the failures of this already established schools, both public and private. And they said, no. We are going back to what people in previous generations, in, say, 1920, 1900, what they would have considered education to be all about. We're going back to that. And we want our English teachers actually to know the language and to know the heritage of literature and so on. Those new schools, they need money. They often run on a shoestring. They're the ones who deserve our money because they're producing people who are actually going to be educated. They're going to be very rare, these people who can talk reasonably about literature and history and so on. But we need 100 more for every school of that sort that we have now. In the meantime, we can support the ones that are there. They deserve our money.
You also say that it's not just a matter of new schools with a different curriculum. Why do you say that?
Well, I'm not sure in what direction to go with this. We need the schools, but schools can't do everything. The job of schools is rather humble, though necessary. Most of the passing along of culture will not happen within the school walls. It happens in our ordinary lives as citizens and as members of church. This is something that needs to inform the whole day, not just a little piece of it there where you happen to be a kid and you happen to be taking an English class or a history class. So, for instance, in our churches, why have we Why have we neglected hundreds and hundreds of years of heritage in our churches? What's up with that? I mean, why, for instance, this is a pet peeve of mine. Why do we sing garbage in these churches when you had pretty good poetry, sometimes great poetry, set to beautiful music in the native tongue? I'm not just thinking about Latin hymns, but in English also. We have these, okay? They're theologically profound. The music is beautiful. The words are noble. There's quite a range of styles from folk all the way to translations of ancient Latin hymns in English, from chant to classical music to various folk melodies from different countries in Europe and the United States. We've had all of this, and odds gone, it's been replaced by twaddle, by stuff that is to that as a paint-by-numbers picture of Lassie is to, you know, a real painting. It doesn't even have to be a painting by Titian or Raphael or Michelangelo, but a real painting by somebody who knew how to paint. Instead, we have paint-by-numbers pictures of Jesus playing wiffle ball with the kids, and bad paint-by-number pictures at that. Well, there's an example of a colossal cultural loss. Well, let's do something about it. Let's not put up with it anymore. Let's recover what we've lost there, what we've allowed to collect dust in the attic.
Let's talk about the sexual revolution. What has been its chief casualty?
The love that should exist between man and woman. That's the chief casualty. That I said this years ago, and I think I lost a friend as soon as I said it. I said that the diabolical purpose of feminism, but I think we could say that about the sexual revolution too, the diabolical purpose, whatever the purposes of the individuals involved were, the diabolical purpose was to kill love between man and woman. And that it has done very nicely. It's interesting to me to watch movies, screwball comedies or romantic comedies from the 40s, and see how the men and the women are frustrated by the differences between men and women, but also immensely attracted by them. And they are grateful for the other sex. Almost all of that is gone. The sexes now are suspicious of one another. They resent one another. You have women's studies programs every place. They say not a single good thing about men the whole year long. We have 40% of our children born out of wedlock now in the United States. A large majority of people at age 30 are not married. This is unprecedented. And there you go. So I call it the lonely revolution, because what it has resulted in are families blown to smithereens, families that never formed in the first place, and people living alone. It's horrible. It's a horrible thing. It is absolutely no mitigating virtues. Any churchman who thinks that we can come to some kind of terms with the sexual revolution is a fool. It has to be rejected. All of it. No exceptions.
Where does the ever-growing list... You mentioned before LGBTQ, and then there's A and I and T, and I don't even know what they stand for. I could guess. But the increasing list of both genders and orientations, where does it fit into that?
Well, when you have blown to bits the cultural institution that should bring man and woman together and give a safe haven for the children that are born from their union. So you've blown marriage to bits. Sure, people still get married, but the divorce rate hovers between 40 and 50%, and now a lot of people don't even bother to get married. When you've done that, right, then chaos reigns, okay? Because they've done at the same time, what you do, especially to boys in school, you give them no model of manhood to follow. So manhood, that's just a stupid notion. It has no meaning. Womanhood, stupid notion, has no meaning. Well, I mean, it's... So you've left all of these young people with all of their drives, all of their confusions. It's an extraordinarily lonely world already. They may have
family lives that are insane, that have no order to them at all. So what are they going to do? Their own sense of identity is precarious. They have no culture to hang on to because that's all been smashed to pieces too. So what do they do? They embark upon the fads of self-invention. I'm an A, B, C, D, E, F, G, different gender adjectives and so on. So it makes me somehow special. So I have at least a handle on myself. In ordinary human times, you don't need that. You say, well, what are you? Well, I'm a man. Well, what's that? Well, everybody knows what a man is. You can't say that anymore. So it's all chaos. It's all chaos. And the kids who are doing this are to be pitied, but not to be given into.
How does that affect family?
It's a vicious cycle. Such people are really not well prepared to begin a family. Let's suppose that you got a young man and a young woman, and let's grant them that they think about themselves as simply, an ordinary man, an ordinary woman. They're going to get married. Because of the sexual revolution and because of the contempt with which ordinary manhood and ordinary womanhood have been heaped for their whole lives, they've absorbed it from the time they went to kindergarten, right? It's all over the mass media, mass entertainment. They don't know what to do. They have no notion what to do with their desires. They find to their amazement that males and females are very different. They have no way to negotiate that. They're going constantly to be surprised by the guy, surprised that the woman over there, once she's got married, doesn't feel like hanging about the bars anymore. The guy, once she's gotten married to him, he doesn't want to gossip about their neighbors as their girlfriends do. They don't know what to expect from one another. They don't know what to give to one another. So they end up kind of like, not men and women, but males and females at sea and adolescent still. Not grown up inside, but in a protracted adolescence. It's a lousy recipe for family life.
10 more minutes on the other side of the break with Dr. Anthony Esselin, professor of English at Providence College, author of several books, including his latest, Out of the Ashes, Rebuilding American Culture. When we come back, we're going to be talking about the way back not only to truth, but also to freedom. Stay tuned.
Dr. Anthony Esselin will be speaking on the topic of imagination and education at the second annual Wittenberg Academy Family Retreat, which will be held at Camp Okoboji in Milford, Iowa on April 27th through the 29th, 2017. Join us and be immersed in God's Word, thoughtful discussions, and family fun. For more information or to register, visit www.wittenbergacademy.org and click on the registration tab.
Metro East Lutheran High School in Edwardsville, Illinois, engages young adults in a Christ-centered environment, delivering academic excellence and spiritual growth to develop Christian leaders for tomorrow. We provide a Christ-focused alternative to public high schools. Many of our students receive tuition assistance. To help us provide tuition assistance to more students, go to melhs.org and click on the giving page, or call me, Dr. J. Krause, principal, at 618-656-0043.
Education and edification. You're listening to Issues Etc.
At Concordia University Irvine, you can pursue advanced theological study for academic, professional, or personal development. Concordia's Master of Arts in Theology program is grounded in the truth of Scripture and insights from the Lutheran Confessions. Courses are taught online and at intensive on-campus sessions in the summer. Apologetics, Christian education leadership, and Reformation studies are just a few of the emphases offered. For more information, visit cui.edu/theology.
If you're like me, you remember when education was about the basic skills of reading, writing, and arithmetic, and about reading great literature and history that gave our kids models of what it is to be a good person. Memoria Press's classical Christian curriculum is bringing this kind of education back. Get $5 off your next order by using the coupon code LPR. For more information, go to memoriapress.com. Memoria Press, saving Western civilization one student at a time.
Folks, LCMS Disaster Response is providing spiritual and human care for southeastern Louisiana after several tornadoes hit that area earlier this month. You can find out about their efforts at lcms.org/disaster, lcms.org/disaster, providing physical and spiritual care in wake of disasters, LCMS Disaster Response. We're talking about the restoration of truth and the decay of Western civilization. Dr. Anthony Esselin is our guest. Dr. Esselin, let's talk about a way back, not only to truth, but you say to freedom. And you liken freedom to a man who works for a father whom he loves and whom he trusts, into whom he has taken his soul, it says. Talk about that view of freedom to which we should be aspiring.
That's something that any pagan, Roman or Greek, would understand, and what any Jew in the Old Testament would understand, and the Christians would understand, and all the great English poets until the day before yesterday would have understood. We don't understand it because we bought this idea that hierarchy is by its very nature evil, and that obedience is for chumps, and that authority is always something to be questioned, that maybe even is always illegitimate because it involves a restraint on those over whom the authority exercises governance. Nobody before the day before yesterday would have believed that in our great tradition. Everybody would have understood that obedience was a virtue and that the role of the, let's say, the head of the household or the priest in a parish, the role is not to suppress the individuality of the people beneath them, but to govern them, to guide them so that they can become more than spoiled brats. They are trained up in virtue, and virtue is not easy to acquire. Virtue is difficult. Well, it might involve a little bit of disgruntlement along the way, but ultimately what you get, my analogy is of a grown son, okay, who obeys his father, but whom his father trusts implicitly, so that the son has very wide fields for action because the father's commands are not experienced by him as restraining him, but as enabling him, as giving him power. Its virtue is a power. Shakespeare would have understood this. Milton, all the great English poets would have understood this. We don't understand it, but that's because we've trained ourselves to be brats, to be spoiled little adolescents. And if anybody really wants a good idea of what this kind of freedom in obedience is all about, go to the plays of Shakespeare, go to Milton's Paradise Lost, and then get back to me.
You end the book talking about the word progressive or progress and how it's been stolen. You put us in mind of John Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, and say that there's a progress afoot today that has detached itself from the pilgrim. Talk about that, if you would.
Yeah, well, the idea that Christian life, or human life in general, is a pilgrimage to God, that's essential to Christian thought. That goes all the way back to the early days of Christianity, that way of thinking of this life as being on a journey. Ultimately, it's all over the Jewish scriptures, the Old Testament, too. Well, I think that that's an accurate way to view our life, to view human life. Well, when progressivism detached itself from the Christian faith, it lost the sense of pilgrimage, but it didn't lose the drive to go someplace. So now what we have is this drive, but there's no aim. There's no coherent goal. We're just going. We end up thinking that change for change's sake is good. We say that we want progress, but as soon as you ask somebody, well, what exactly are you progressing towards? What's the destination? They have no idea.
and seems to be motivated instead by a hatred of what came before than by any real longing for something that's clearly defined in your mind. It becomes instead a rage to destroy, and it has destroyed a lot. Progressivism as an ideology has destroyed a lot in the last 100 years.
You also say that progressives of our time no longer bother to tell us where they believe they're going. They neither know nor care.
No, they don't. They don't. Do you ever hear any of them say, this is going to be the aim, this is the ideal world, this is where we want to go? They never say that. Never say that. And funny thing is, whenever moderates, a moderate is basically somebody who just doesn't want to give a damn, when they say, okay, well, we'll give them this, they'll make them happy. And of course it doesn't make them happy, because they don't have their hearts set upon any coherent good. The mode of progressivism now is entirely negative. It involves a rage against. So you give them something, that rage doesn't go away. It just moves on to something else. So you allow a man to pretend that he can marry a man. Well, the destructive rage doesn't end there. He's not satisfied. So, okay, well, now we've reached the haven. Now we can be ordinary people again. No, it has to go farther. It has to. Because there never was an aim except the aim to undo. And that's like a yawning chasm within the soul. Can't fill it.
What happens when that impulse is given the machinery of democracy, as you say, without the soul of democracy?
It destroys everything in sight. Nothing can stand against it then. The ancient philosophers understood this too. If that's what we mean by democracy, then we're one step away from tyranny. Plato said that, and that wisdom has been repeated over the ages. That's why our own founding fathers were deeply suspicious of democracy, because they saw what happened with Athens and her democracy, and they were afraid of the passions of the mob. They knew if you were talking about government but not about self-government, then you might as well invite King George back. He was a moderate monarch. A tyranny of the mob is a great deal more destructive and more intrusive on freedom than King George ever was. Bring back King George.
Finally, this might sound familiar to you. How do you respond to someone who says that the ideas that you've expressed this hour and that you want to see extolled again were just ideas created by an oppressive majority of white men and white male privilege?
I'm talking about ideas that stretch back to the earliest writings of the Jewish Old Testament. So now we're going back 3,000 years, and we're spanning cultures that are widely divergent in geography, in political organization, and in stages of technological development. To reduce all of that to say, well, it was all the same. To reduce all of that to just this little silly little slogan, "Oh, they were just white males." That's stupid. I mean, that's just, as somebody who talks like that simply doesn't know what he's talking about. Has never studied the cultures in question, and to say that it's illegitimate because the people who came up with these things had a certain level of melanin in their skin, rather than a certain other level of melanin, you might as well be talking to me about the characteristic bumps on their heads. What relevance is that, right? And plenty of these peoples also were not the oppressors. They were trying to liberate themselves from being oppressed. I mean, that's the history of the Jews. Basically, you can't say that. No person with any kind of decent historical knowledge would say something as foolish as that.
Dr. Anthony Esselin is professor of English at Providence College, author of several books, including his latest, Out of the Ashes, Rebuilding American Culture. Folks, when you purchase this book using the Amazon link at our website, a portion of your purchase will support the worldwide outreach of Issues, etc. Go to issuesetc.org, click Listen on Demand, and look for Out of the Ashes by Anthony Esselin. Dr. Esselin, thank you very, very much.
Thank you very much, Todd.
Tomorrow on Issues, Etc., we'll have Pastor Tom Baker lead us in a Sunday school lesson on Jesus healing a blind man in John chapter 9. The latest Issues, Etc. journal, which you can find online and absolutely free, contains the final essay in a series I've been doing on myths regarding both the gospel and the law. I write about gospel reduction and its dangerous effects in theology in the latest Issues, Etc. journal. You can subscribe absolutely free at our website, issuesetc.org. Click the red subscription button and enter your email address. I'm Todd Wilkin. I'll talk with you tomorrow. Thanks for listening to Issues, Etc.
Listen weekday afternoons to Pastor Todd Wilkin and guests on Issues, Etc. Issues, Etc. is a listener-supported program. Your financial support is vital for the continuation and expansion of this worldwide outreach. Our mailing address, Issues, Etc., P.O. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. Box 83, Collinsville, Illinois, 62234. You can also donate at our website, issuesetc.org. Issues, Etc. is a production of LPR, Lutheran Public Radio.
St. Paul's Lutheran Church in Wildwood, Missouri is a proud sponsor of Issues, Etc. And if you enjoy the relevant, Christ-centered teachings presented on this program, then you should come and join us at St. Paul's on Sundays at 9 a.m., where you will hear sermons that proclaim Jesus Christ and Him crucified for our sins, and enjoy in-depth Bible studies to help us grow as disciples. For more information, check us out at stpaullutheranwildwood.org.
College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois offers ACT, SAT, and PSAT test prep, scholarship application classes, college and career counseling, and more. Hi, this is Lori Konski, president of College Preparation Station. We have helped our students obtain more than $7 million in tuition scholarships in 12 years. Find out more at cpsprep.com. Let us help you create a vision and find your future. The College Preparation Station in Maryville, Illinois, cpsprep.com.